All right, so what did everybody do for Halloween?
I went to a wedding.
Oh, that's right. How was the wedding?
What?
That was cool.
/ high school reunion, right?
No, there were only eight or nine of us there.
Only the cool kids showed up?
Yeah. Couple that went to my high school after I left. Couple that graduated before me.
So me and Jeff found a friend's house in Costa Mesa to pass candy out at because nobody comes to our house.
Oh.
So we dressed up. He was a Jedi and I was Elsa.
I saw your pictures.
Yeah, we saw the pictures.
And so it was like, hey, we live, you know, six houses over. We're like, oh, that's great. We didn't really want to explain that we didn't live there. We just wanted to pass out candy to kids.
That's the thing about getting your own kids.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, it's so cool that you guys dress up to pass out candy. We're like, yeah, no one's going to give us any candy. Go door to door. We just have to just give it out.
Well, just grab somebody's kid and take them up to the door and get your own.
I know. Well, I borrowed Tom's kids last year, but I don't know if they did this year. Well, no, we went to Mickey's Not So Scary Halloween party with them.
This year, yeah.
Yeah, but we didn't get any candy there either. We snuck in.
We're not supposed to have candy anyway.
I know.
There was so much candy at the wedding.
Really?
Oh, dear.
And I had none. I was so good.
We passed out sugar-free candy.
Oh, you cruel lady.
Hoping our friend's house wouldn't get egged. But we only gave them a piece each so they wouldn't get sick off of it.
No.
Because you can eat too much sugar-free candy. It will have a very negative effect on your digestion tract.
Well, I wanted to dress up like Dr. Whom.
Oh, no.
He travels the galaxy correcting people's grammar.
So, besides that...
So much silence.
Yeah, that was longer than 3 seconds.
What did you actually dress up as? I like that one.
Yep.
Were you Batman?
No, I didn't dress up at all. I sat on my couch and watched TV and threw candy at kids when they came to my door.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
So, on Halloween, what does Batman go as?
Robin.
Point to ponder.
Here's another point to ponder. If you had your choice between your wife and winning the lottery, what would be the first car you buy?
Famous last word. Mm-hmm. All right. Ready?
Ready.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Hi, this is Tom Mills, H.R. Harmer Stamp Auctions. You're listening to the podcast for a stamp show here today.
It's hard to send up. It's hard to send up.
Stamp collecting happens when we dream together.
Welcome to Stamp Show Here Today, episode number 52.
Yay, 1 year.
Yay.
Are there 52 weeks in a year?
Yes. in the northern hemisphere, yes.
Oh, I've never counted before.
Send all your questions, comments, and harassment mail to.
You know, people fear what they don't understand, and I think that you're in a perpetual state of terror.
Okay, I'm sitting here with Scott, Cash, Don, and Jeff, and I'm your host, Jessica. You can find us on Facebook at Stamp Show Here Today and on Twitter at Stamp Show HT. Or you can call us and leave a message at country code 1-949-873-4298. Tell your friends they can find us on iTunes, Podbay, and Stitcher, and several more now. You can actually Google us and run like 3 more platforms.
Yeah, it just kind of generates itself at this point.
So let's talk about stamps. This week we'll be talking about stamp news, the new Scott catalog. # stamp stories, # your first time, it's not where you think it is. And our expert topic of the week is stamp color history. So, stamp news, the new specialized Scott catalog is out as a...
It's that bad?
Uh-oh. As is
a nod to Halloween.
You're a little late.
As is the 2016 U.S. catalog. Thousands of value changes, hundreds of new listings, and tons of editorial, quote, improvements. Depends who you ask. Including many revised and expanded listings can be found in the 2016 Scott Classic Specialized Catalog of Stamps and Covers, 1840 to 1940. And I know we have one in the office, don't we?
Yes.
What do you guys think? What, that you paid a lot of money for it?
Well, first of all, yes. Well, that yes. Too. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That was an expensive catalog.
Those jerks.
I like, you know, I deal with classics, so I like their layout of the classics, but I think most of that was done last year. I don't think anything really new occurred this year.
Well, the values in the classic area for the great of very fine, which is what the catalog lists, are down. But stamps aren't down. I mean, the better material, the best stuff that's in better than the grade that they have the catalog in, a lot of it is up.
Oh, I was going to go over that after we start talking about the auction, telling the trends, because I also spoke with some, let's say, worldwide people, some people from across the country and across the ocean, about where the stamp market is today. And so stick around. Turn off the background noise and listen to this.
But we are the background noise, aren't we?
Oh, good point. Well, pay attention to your background noise.
Okay, so this 2016 edition of the catalog, the 22nd edition, widely regarded as the best single-volume catalog for the classic era stamps of the world, incorporates more than 15,850 value changes. When all the value changes made in the 6-volume 2016 Scott Standard Postage Stamp Catalog listings are included, the total surges to more than 35,000 changes. So who decides these changes?
Oh, there are advisors.
There's a bevy.
In almost every country.
There's a bevy of advisors.
Yes.
A plethora of advisors, you might even say?
Scott yes. is one of the advisors here. We actually have cool. one of the Scott's Catalog advisors sitting here at this table.
Ooh.
But I know several. I know Martin, Ray Martin does the Philippines.
Oh.
And I know a couple people who do Germany. Germany has a massive number of people contributing.
A lot of our specialized dealers do contribute.
Yeah. Hmm.
So stamp value changes are all over the board. Some climbed dramatically, while others lost almost half of their value. For example, Russia's number one increased dramatically in unused condition from $25,000 in the 2015 edition to $62,500 in the 2016 edition. But Woo-hoo. The used values drops from $850 to $775. That is strange.
That's not too bad.
So values from Cuba have undergone a thorough review. Almost 700 values have changed, with a significant increase throughout. Scott number 5 jumped from 1,200 unused to 1,500 and from 210 used to 400.
That is, so I wonder what, that's really a factor that they never had a market value for Cuba.
I wonder why they did Cuba this year.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah. Since Cuba was never listed before, you'd expect for a lot of changes to go on. And when they first start listing something, they always go low because they don't want to lower prices. So they'll start low and then go up as they figure out where the market is.
Yeah, but they listed them. They just there was no action on it because of the embargo.
And well, you couldn't buy and sell them in the United States.
Yeah, so they just never looked at them and never changed them. Even though you could buy and sell them at stamp shows, there really wasn't a whole lot of nobody wanted to acknowledge that they were selling Cuban stamps.
Mm-hmm.
Even the stuff that was legal to buy and sell. Nobody wanted to admit to it, and the eBay's policy kind of touches on that, too.
Right.
Yeah, you had to sell cube stamps, right? Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Cub stamps, cube stamps.
You weren't allowed to say cube, otherwise you get, like, blacklisted immediately. You cannot sell this.
They just get taken off, yeah.
And they send you to Guantanamo Bay.
Exactly.
You get embargoed.
Yep.
Yeah, but if you list a Guantanamo Bay Cuba cover from like the 1920s, they'll still take it down.
Yeah.
Well,
U.S. possessions.
Legitimate.
When I was selling U.S. possessions for Cuba, I would spell it C-U-B-E because C-U-B-A, their little robot would go out there and cancel the auction.
Mm-hmm. That happened to us once for something. What did we have? We had something where it automatically yanked it out for us.
It was a postcard.
Yeah.
And now we're post-embargo, so we'll see how long eBay takes to catch up to that
theft. Oh, they already have.
Oh, really?
No, they haven't.
Oh.
No, I'm listing stuff on Cuba, and it's all staying up. Sudan, however, is still one of the same things as, you know, post, I believe their independence was in 1962. So from 1962 to today, you're not allowed to sell the stamps of Sudan. Pre-1962, when they had their mandate and everything like that, perfectly legal. But if you put Sudan in the description, eBay automatically takes it down because they don't know whether it's from 1962 or not.
They're not
stamp collectors.
They don't care.
Yeah, they don't care. They want to avoid.
It's a blanket policy.
Exactly.
Okay, another value changes for France. A mix of increases and decreases resulted in 221 value changes. Their Scott number 7 fell from 3,750 unused to 3,400 and 475 used to 425.
Dear France, your Star Wars stamps suck.
And it is
signed
now,
cash.
And it is now reflecting in your other stamp values.
Taking you down. Many editorial changes have been made this time around, adding things that previously might have been overlooked, including such things as on-cover items for Afghanistan. For the first time, various paper, color, and perforation varieties in several countries. And as always, users of the catalog should pay special attention to the number editions, deletions, and changes listings in the catalog. Wow, deletions?
Yes. Yes.
Unlisted things?
Yes.
I didn't know that happened. So why would they delete something?
They move it to another place, or they find out that the stamp is a variety of another stamp, so they will delist it.
Or they determine that it doesn't exist because what they thought existed was faked. That happens sometimes.
Yeah, most of it, though, is moving around.
Yeah. Most
I mean, you see that in the U.S. catalog where...
What's the one you can harass dealers with saying you're looking for a blah, 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 doesn't exist anymore?
Yeah, I believe it's 1215 through 1217.
Oh, you're talking about
they come out after the Pershing issue, the Ascent Pershing.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's like a block of about five numbers that don't exist, and you just go up to dealers and ask for those.
The smart one will get you the right stamps anyway, but...
talking about number additions and deletions kind of brings up a really good point. When you get a new catalog, you should always read through the front, all of the... And there can be like 40, 50, 60 pages of it, but you should always read through it. And I would recommend reading through it every once in a while, maybe every year or so anyway, because... The information in there tells you how to use the catalog, but it also defines things. And as you mature as a stamp collector, a lot of these things will make more and more sense every time you read it. And it'll help explain certain parts of the listings or certain processes in stamp printing or certain errors and things like that. And it's just a good information to review.
So hashtag stamp stories, our first time. This last weekend, Jeff and I went to our first real stamp auction, as in not eBay, joining Cash, Stamp Show Steve, Brian, and quite a few other stamp buddies at the 75th H.R. Harmer Stamp Auction held at the Costa Mesa Hilton Hotel. The auction ran from October 29 through 31, which was Halloween, and featured a huge amount of items, including one of our own mixed lots that got some action, but did not end up meeting the reserve.
No.
It happens, apparently. We got our own bidder number on day three and bid on a couple of items and actually won a really cool box of old German stamps that focused on the interbellum and inflationary periods and included some older stamps and a couple of German classics. I think we stole the show and you won that.
You did.
Okay, maybe I helped.
There was actually in the audio commentary, it was something about I needed to wipe the lipstick off my face.
Yeah. Yes, there was.
And people at home going, what?
Yeah, you won. You go, oh, goody, and turned and kissed them. And the auctioneer goes, aw.
Look at the noobs in the front row. When we were previewing auction lots, Google let us down. We heard the term plebiscites. Am I saying that right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Google search spit out some long, convoluted history of World War II and Hitler's schemes, and we kind of gave up, something about voting and this, that, and the other, and we just gave up and turned to Cash and said, can you explain what the heck plebiscites are? And then it actually all made sense.
He made sense in about 20 seconds.
Yeah. So what are plebiscites, Cash?
Well, plebiscite is when they were divvying up Europe. They didn't know what places to put in what countries, so they just said, we're not going to make this decision. We're going to let the people vote, and you know, you have 10 years to figure it out. So a lot of small areas were put into plebiscites, and in 10 years they elected, or through an election, they decided what country they joined.
And we cared because in that intermediate period, they actually had their own stamps.
They did. They were actually country entities during the plebiscite period. They had their own governments.
Is this some kind of government gray area period?
I don't think most of them didn't last 10 years, though. Most of them were much, much shorter.
They gave up.
Some of them were as little as a year, and some of them were, most of them I think were 4 or 5 years.
No. They wanted to make it long enough where people didn't vote based on emotions. And they wanted to have
good
people,
luck with that.
Yeah,
right?
they wanted to have the areas able to sort of placate whatever problems they had, and for the surrounding company or countries to actually do something and say, you know, this is what we're going to do or not. And I can't think of any that were that short. Most of them were quite a distance because, again, they wanted to get that emotional feeling out of the way, so they put them off into the future.
Well, don't Google it because that's
it
a
gets
dead
weird
end.
Really yeah. fast.
It's pre-internet, so all the facts are kind of convoluted.
What were there countries you can think of as examples that exist now? Or areas that got chopped up back then?
Oh, yeah. Quite a few. All around Germany, all around Romania, little bits of Hungary. Fiume never was a plebiscite, I don't think, but it was its own entity that eventually decided where it was going to go. There's quite a few of them.
Interesting.
None of which were huge. You know, it wasn't like Poland was determining. It was like, you know, this county in Western France was trying to figure out where to go.
Interesting.
Okay, so how do you guys think the stamp auction values determined the market this time?
Well, here's what I saw, and this is from quite a few people, is that Western Europe, starting about 6 months ago, was a little soft, and it's getting softer. However, that being said, the quality stuff from Western Europe is really strong. So it's sort of along the lines of where the value is. If it's an expensive item, it's good. If it's a more common item, it's going down in value. And if it's from Western Europe, it's going down in value more. Mint Never Hinge, British Commonwealth, and not just China, but all of Southeast Asia is doing well. And the Japan did very, very well also.
Oh, there was some stupid Japan lot that I looked at it and I went, this is crap. This is postage.
Well, that's some beautiful souvenir sheets.
Yeah, man. But I mean, from just a collector standpoint or a dealer standpoint, it was nothing. And it sold for 3 times what I thought I was going to go for. Yep. I couldn't believe it.
And I wanted it.
China, yeah. as soft as China is, it's still going up at the upper level. The uncommon stuff is going very well. The common stuff, not so well.
Yeah, it was 1960s and up.
Yeah.
So I pulled the lot hoping that there was a Hello Kitty collection in it.
Ah.
And there wasn't.
It stopped a couple of years before the first Hello Kitty stamp.
2002.
Yep.
So. Rats to you.
I know.
I really looked. And there was a Star Trek collection I wanted really bad, but it was valued way too high for just wanting something. I know.
It was two stacks of 22 different commemorative holders that were all the same. So you had A and B and 22 of each. And you wanted way too much for them.
Yeah, but they're for $20 on eBay. This is an argument we had on the way home. So.
Yeah, this is what we were doing in the viewing room.
Yeah. They're like, oh, look at the cute little couple arguing over stamps. That was us. So, what was your first fun experience in something new and stamp related? Tell us about it on Twitter, hashtag stamp stories, hashtag first time. So tell us about the first item you won even on in an auction. Real auction, not eBay.
Yeah, you can dig for eBay if you want.
Okay, so updates. Cash's corrections.
Well, I don't have any corrections, but I have a couple of updates. First of all, hail fellows, well met.
Why is Don looking at me like that?
The guy who was selling the $2.5 million worth of stamps that we reported, must have been, what, 4 episodes ago?
Mm-hmm.
And he had like $2.5 million worth of stamps and $3 million worth of stamps in the other one. He has another one up that just sold. It sold for $8,600. It was worth better than $1 million. Well, it had a Pan American cover that at the H.R. Harmer auction was in that auction. So in Santa Ana, California, Costa Mesa, California, I held that cover in my hand.
Well, it's a unique one of a kind. No mistaking it.
It's a unique one of a kind. No mistaking it. I held it in my hand. It was not sold on eBay. You might have bought a picture of it. You might have bought something, a laser print of it, but I held the original in my hand. I know that that wasn't there. The second item was there was 4 margin copies of the 1869 stamps inverted centers that were proofs. That's another unique item. It sold in Siegel a couple days earlier. I did not hold that one in my hand, but I know Siegel had it. So there is no question this guy does not own these stamps. So whoever paid this guy $8,600, go stand by your mailbox and wait.
I hope you get your money back.
Well, it's funny because I was just digging through his feedback, and all of his feedback is positive. He's got a couple of neutrals, but it doesn't say anything bad. But every single one of the positives he has
is written in French.
Well, most of them are in French. There's like one English, one or two in German, but they're all incredibly generic. Great eBayer, smooth transaction, A+, we'll do business again. That's all in various combinations. That's all any of them said. They're so bland and generic. I'm starting to think it's just for money laundering. You pay 13%, you flood your money that you need to move from A to B, and you get a bunch of people with accounts to bid on your stuff. The guy puts in an absurd amount that there's no way that anybody's going to be able to outbid him, and then you get to launder a percentage of your money through. I think it's pretty easy.
Well, he laundered $8,600.
Yeah.
That's hardly worth the effort.
Well, it's determined upon, the other suckers that are actually trying to bid on it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the second item is Canada. We were talking about the Canadian Halloween stamps. And the Halloween stamps are forever stamps. And I believe they're 69 cent stamps or 65 cents. They're something like that. Well, Canada is raising their postal rates to $1 December 31st. And so if you buy the stamps now, they'll be worth $1 in 2 months. So depending on how you want to play it, because they have stopped the sale of all forever stamps. But for some reason, you can still buy the Halloween stamps online. So you can buy 69 cent stamps today that will be worth a dollar in 2 months, just in case anybody out there wants to do any speculation. And then the third thing is West 6. I also want to thank West 6 on stamp boards. He gave us a lot of praise, said we were doing a good job. He's in Hong Kong. And so I wanted to give a shout out to him and thank you very much for your nice comments.
Okay, I'd like to give a huge thanks to Neo Kroll for your generous donation to our little podcast. Well, not so small anymore, really.
Nope.
Stamp Show here today really appreciates the contribution. Hopefully we can upgrade some of our equipment and maybe even buy some real ads somewhere. Okay.
Maybe we can buy a good book of jokes for cash.
Right. Hire a joke writer.
So, my updates are, so our selling stamps on eBay topic from episode 51 blew up our social media. Shocker. Aaron Hubbard said, I didn't hear a discussion of sniping techniques for winning eBay auctions. I found that this saves me money and time again on eBay.
Well, guess what? We're going to have to do a follow-up in a couple of weeks. Aaron, there were a number of topics we didn't get to.
Yeah.
Aaron, thank you so much for the comment. I love you as a listener, but I freaking hate you on eBay.
Well, that's because you're a seller.
Yeah.
No, that doesn't bother me. It's when I'm sitting there for 2 days winning an item, going, yeah, I'm going to get that for a good price. And somebody with 2 seconds left comes in and floods it with bids. You jerk. So,
one isn't a flood. Just because you weren't willing to bid enough.
At least the ones that are humorous, is Scott, you're right. It's when it's not one person that does it, but you suddenly get maybe three that did it all at the same time, and it just through the roof.
That'll teach you not to enter your real bid.
Right?
As a seller, you know, I'll look and I'll see that I may have like 25 things with bids. And I just don't even look at until the last day. And then on the last day, I may have like 50 bids.
Wow.
And at the last hour, I'll have 100. And in the last 45 seconds, I'll have 500.
Wow. Yeah.
So my direct answer to him on Facebook was, it does work true. It's also sort of a controversial subject. But while it works, the people it happens to usually aren't very happy about it.
Oh, it's part of the game. It's like saying, you know, I don't think we should have to run 100 yards in a football game. I think we should only have to run 50. It's like, dude, the rules are snipers are fine. Live with it. And if I was there, I'd be using a sniper myself.
Well, honestly, I think I'd feel better about using it myself if someday we open up a second account, just because I would feel kind of awkward handing over my login information to a company that I don't know for my seller account, where they could actually cause some issues.
Oh, but they've been around for so long. You know, they're very trustworthy.
Well, I remember using a sniping service way back before they had Buy It Now as an option. They only had auctions as an option. And yes, it made sense to actually have a sniping service available for that. Now, I'd only use it very infrequently because most of the time it really didn't matter whether I got the lot or not. But if it was something I really, really, really wanted, then I'd use a sniping service. But most of the time you didn't. And I never paid for it. I used one of the free services. And with sniping services, the more you pay, the closer to the end second you get.
Well, they make money. They make about a nickel off every email address they get. So when you register, they made a nickel off you.
So another reason we didn't talk about it is because we frequently give out our mailing address, which is Stamp Show Here Today, P.O. Box 6170, Newport Beach, California, 92658. So send us your love or expressions of hatred of snipers to that mailbox.
Or questions you want us to cover in the follow-up episode.
Also true.
Or letters with a Monty Python stamp on it from Britain.
Oh, yeah.
Or a Star Wars stamp. Or a Star Wars stamp.
Okay, so on to our expert topic, stamp color history. We have talked in the past about stamp colors and how many varieties can exist, and also about how hard it can be for the collecting community to come up with a true standardization for ink colors. This week, while talking about why certain color choices did and didn't work out, we decided to talk about the colors themselves and how they came to be. So, you guys, why is a penny black not such a good idea?
Well, the penny black, the cheapest ink out there, and this is history going back to, I don't know how long, you know, pick a date, 1200 or whatever. But the cheapest ink to make is black ink. So they made black stamps. And then the postmasters said the cheapest ink to get is black ink. We're going to cancel these black stamps with black ink. And as a revenue protection source, canceling a black stamp with black ink is not the best idea.
Well, I mean, the penny black has most of the area of the stamp is black, whereas if you had fine lines and most of the paper showed through, it would be a lot easier to see the black cancel. But that's not the way they made the stamps. So.
Well, also, well, yes, that's great if you look at it, but I had a great – I love this story. It talks about the New York Post Office in the 1880s and how they would cancel the stamps. And it was described as mind-numbing because all you did was you had a little hammer and you'd whack the ink pad, then you'd whack the stamp, then you'd take the next envelope, whack the ink pad, whack the stamp, and you would do that for 10 straight hours.
Oh my God.
You'd get a break every now and then. Remember, these guys, they didn't have like unions and stuff. They worked 10 hours. So in the end of the day, you're working under like candlelight or kerosene lamps.
You can't see. You've got carpal tunnel.
Whacking stamps. So I don't care how impressive the filigree of the Great Britain number one is. You're not looking at the stamps. And so when they finally said, hey, we're going to change this, we're going to make the stamps black, but you're going to use red cancels. Well, red ink was more expensive and you had to buy it all over the place. So finally they got smart and said, hey, why don't we print the stamps in red, put a black cancel on it, and from that point on, everybody in the world, with some exceptions, one of which is the United States, stopped making black stamps and canceling them with black ink.
Is that why a lot of U.S. number ones have like an orange, reddish cancel on them?
They tried everything to try to make, again, it was revenue protection. And it's interesting because, you know, they went through the grilling process in the 1860s here in the United States to try to protect their revenue, and at the same time made black stamps, which was, in my opinion, one of the dumbest things you could do. You don't make black stamps and then cancel them with black ink.
Hey, 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 black stamps matter.
Oh!
Sorry.
Okay, so that explains kind of why certain colors were chosen, like cost effectiveness, huh?
Well, revenue protection, he was saying.
Okay.
Well, it starts out, the black stamps are chosen for cost effectiveness, and then they were changed for revenue protection.
Oh.
Yeah, there are very few countries that made black stamps later on, U.S. being one, Austria being one, and, you know, that's pretty much it. It's kind of U.S. and Austria. There's a couple scattered ones around. But after, you know, 1850, not too many, everybody kind of learned their lesson.
So do you think certain colors were avoided to save money? Like more expensive pigments and stuff?
Definitely.
Without a doubt.
Yeah, definitely. But one of the stamp colors that was avoided, or should have been avoided, is the color yellow.
Oh, I hate that color on stamps.
Yellow stamps. And I collect Austria and the early Austrian stamps that are yellow, and Switzerland also has this problem. They're invisible. You can't see them. If you get a canceled yellow stamp, it's a white piece of paper that looks like it's a little toned, and then you have a black cancel. It's incredibly difficult to see a yellow stamp.
So who was the first person to decide the colors? Was it a government or agency?
Well, every government, I guess, decided their own colors until 1874 when the Universal Postal Union came about.
Was it 1874? Yeah. It was after that.
No, I believe they were organized in 1874, and then they became standardized in 1878.
Oh, okay.
So for those that don't know, what is the Universal Postal Union?
That is it's an international organization that kind of coordinates stamp treaties between different countries, before the Universal Postal Union, every country had to negotiate the rate treaty with its neighbors and with every other country. So you might be able to send a letter to Great Britain for 5 cents, whereas to Canada it might cost you 15. It depended on how you negotiated your treaties, and that was an example. It's not necessarily true. But when they came along, they got together, and the countries that wanted to participate, they all sent a representative, and they hammered out a treaty rate, basically between every member nation of the Universal Postal Union, so that, say, any letter going from Europe to America would cost the same whether it was going east to west or west to east. And that way, and it also hammered out, okay, when... And then it would guarantee the delivery of these letters at no additional charge within those member countries. And then it would also, at the end of the year, each government was credited with how much of the postage was due, depending on the rates in effect.
Well, let's take for an example. We're here in Santa Ana, California. And we want to mail a letter to Berlin, which sort of is Germany. Prussia wasn't Germany back then. Well, you would, from Santa Ana to New York, would cost 10, I'm going to pick like the 1850s, would cost 10 cents. So then you'd put it on a boat, and the boat charged different rates between 2 cents and 7 cents.
And don't forget you had to pay the captain, too.
Well, that's what it was, 2 cents to 7 cents. And then it would hit Germany. You had no postage on that letter paying postage in Germany. You couldn't get German stamps in Santa Ana, California. So it hit Germany, and it was postage due, and it went on its way postage due. There was no way to prepay it. Or there was, but it was incredibly difficult. You know, you'd hire the ship captain and you'd say, here, put a 30-cent stamp in, on this when it hits land. And that was called the Prussian closed mail rate because it was closed mail. You couldn't buy the stamps elsewhere. I mean, that's not why they called it closed mail, but it just so happens that, you know, it was closed to outside. So, and the same thing happened to France. It would cost 5 cents to get a letter from New York to France, but then it would cost like whatever cents, centimes, it would cost to get to wherever in France it was. And there was no way to prepay it. Well, all of a sudden, the postal UPU comes along and says, yeah, you want to send this letter to Germany? It's going to cost you 30 cents. And you can walk up to your postman and say, here's 30 cents. They put a stamp on it. Boom, it gets all the way to Germany postpaid. Then when it hits Germany, they say, hey, United States, you owe us 17 and a half cents. And we go, thank you very much. Here's your 17 and a half cents. And the letters all go through.
Okay.
So they did quite a few things. That was the main one. The second one was to help everybody recognize everybody else's stamps.
Right. Then the member countries would submit examples of their stamps. This is where specimen stamps come in. And they would submit basically specimens of their stamps to be distributed to the other member countries so that their postal divisions or departments would know what your stamps looked like. And that way, when something came in with a stamp on it and they go, oh, this is from America, but this doesn't look like an American stamp, they'd pull out their specimens and go, oh, well, yeah, look, we don't have one like it, so therefore it's not valid for postage, and they'd charge a post issue. Or, oh, yeah, I guess they issued that last year, and that's the first time we've seen it. It's good. Let it go through.
That is really cool.
Another thing they did, which is one of the things we were talking about is color today, is they standardized color. So if you had a first-class letter going within your own country, it was prescribed to be red. If it was going overseas, it was prescribed to be blue. If it was a postcard, it was supposed to be green. And so these kinds of colors were standardized. So it didn't matter whether your first when you changed your first-class postage rate, it didn't matter, because if they saw an incoming blue stamp, they knew that the postage rate was right for a one-ounce letter going overseas. And then within your own country as well, if the postal clerk saw a red stamp, that indicated a first-class letter fully paid for 1 ounce.
Does that account for the colors that are on the first couple of Pan Americans? Does that correspond to that?
Absolutely.
It's starting to make sense.
And because of competition, all the countries started sort of charging the same amount.
Mm-hmm.
We charged 3 cents, which was basically about a penny and a half. The British had the 1 penny. The French had the 10 centimes. You know, all these countries sort of started standardizing the cost. So the difference, mailing a letter from Britain to France and from France to Germany and from Germany to Italy and from Italy to Poland, they all kind of started to become the same rate. They started becoming very close to each other. Sort of like today, you know, in the United States it's 49 cents, in Canada it's 69 cents. You know, that's a big difference considering it's only 20 cents, but that's a pretty big difference for what we see in the world today. Well, before that, you know, it might have been 25 cents to send a letter from London to Paris, but it could, you know, it might have been $3 to send it from Paris to Milan. Hmm. You know, something like the differences in postal rates were so dramatic.
Another thing that the Universal Postal Union helped out with was a lot of times if a country had a problem with another country, they would charge what are called retaliatory rates, meaning, okay, you're going to charge mail going from your country to my country at 30 cents, well, we're going to charge 70 cents.
Yeah.
And they would go back. It's like having an economic war. And so in the Universal Postal Union, this is supposed to step outside of those political disputes and kind of so that mail moves even across disputed boundaries.
Yeah, you see that too. Not just that, but also the designs of stamps. You'll have like the equivalent of, you know, Germany producing a stamp that says the U.S. sucks. And, you know, they send it across and we don't have to take it. We go to the Universal Postal Union and say, hey, they made a stamp that says the U.S. sucks. And the UPU would say, yeah, that's over the line. You know, Germany, stop it.
Well, stop it, Germany. Stop it.
And this was actually a biggie because you'd have the Arab Emirates, you'd have Egypt, and you know those, and they would send these terrible. They would make these terrible Israeli stamps,
mm-hmm.
and then mail letters to Israel, and Israel would void them, and then Israel would make some stamp and send it to Iran, and Iran would void it, and you know, so all these people were using these political things to try to use these stamps, and some of the most impressive ones were actually to Germany, where Germany, East Germany versus West Germany. And the stamp would come over and they'd take a felt tip pen and cross the stamp out so you couldn't see the stamp and then say, postage due.
Huh. Cute.
I was going to say, did mail ever get across the Berlin Wall? That was going to be my next question.
Oh, all the time.
Yeah. They just charge some kind of retaliatory fee for that?
No.
You fold your letters up in a paper airplane, stand really high on a roof next to the wall.
So, early bicolored stamps. Do you guys have any chance to know who was the first one to two-tone a stamp?
Ooh, good question.
Not off the top of my head, I don't.
The earliest American ones for postage, at least, that I can think of would be the Pan Americans.
Right.
No, it's the 1869s.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, you're right. I'll bet you the 1869s then are going to be...
They're very early, but very I don't know if they were the first.
Because you have the British key...
Key plates?
Key plates. When did those start? I think in the 70s.
Those were, I think, Edward VII?
No, they had Victorias.
Did they have key plates on Victoria?
They had Victorian key plates, yeah. I would guess that Victorian...
Maybe in the 70s.
Yeah, the Victorian key plates.
But that would put the U.S. stamps as earlier in 1869.
Wow, good question. Anybody out there who's listening?
Yeah.
Anybody knows the answer and wants to send it to us?
And next one, if you don't send it, I'll have to bust it down and put it in Cash's corrections.
So that was my, because as printing technology changes, I'm sure someone started getting fancy with it and two-toning things.
Oh, yeah.
And then three-toning, and now we have just works of art in the modern-day stamps. So.
Well, the hitch was, of course, is printing a two-tone stamp. You had to make two plates. You had to press that plate two times. You had twice the work in doing a two-colored stamp. Today, you know, we can do anything you want, and, you know, the offset, we can have rainbows and anything else, and it just passes through the printer once.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons why you find bicolored stamps like that are generally high values in a set, or the high value a lot of times.
And it created some very interesting inverts when they had to run it through twice.
Yep.
So yeah, the some of the other interesting color stories is during World War One, red ink comes from Germany, the good quality stuff.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah.
Bad Jewish jokes coming to mind.
No, this is actual history.
No, this is World War One, not World War Two.
Okay.
In World War One, they didn't care what religion you were. They just hated you. So they had people going to Germany because, of course, we were at war with them. We had a trade embargo with them and everything. You know, we were shooting at them. We couldn't trade with them. And still, in spite of a war going on, we contacted them and say, hey, can we buy some red ink from you? And they said, sure. And they sent a submarine full of red ink that turned around halfway because we said, you know something? We can't complete this transaction. We're really sorry. We'll escort you back. We promise we won't sink you. But that's why during World War II, the 2-cent stamp that we were producing has such a huge range of reds is because we couldn't get red ink. Another thing is that for those of you who collect postcards, you have what's called linen postcards. And linen is because it has sort of a clothy, non-artistic, non-three-dimensional sort of look to it. It looks like, you know, a cartoon drawing instead of like a photograph drawing. And the photograph drawings we couldn't do because we couldn't get the high quality of inks. So we had low quality ink, so we made quote-unquote linen postcards. But yeah, the inability for us to get red ink significantly affected our ability to produce 2-cent stamps, which were the most common stamps being used.
Of course. That would have looked kind of cool if it got sunk, though.
big red spot in the middle of the ocean. Yeah, just Lord. Giant red ink spot.
So what do we have to go to compensate for the lack of red ink?
Oh, we just use whatever we could produce here.
So like...
It pinks just wasn't the quality that
it comes from a bug, and I forget the name of the bug, but we were producing an organic red ink, and they were producing a mineral red ink.
Well, not only that, the inks that we were producing were much more abrasive than the fine inks that we would get from Germany.
Oh, Germany was the chemical king of the world. Yeah. I mean, everything that could be produced chemically, they did better. They made better blue ink. They make better red ink.
But that's one of the reasons why we have this period in the third bureau issue of offset printings is because you have this abrasive ink being produced here in the States to compensate for the ink we can't get. It's wearing away our engraved plates, so they switched to the offset printing process during the war because those inks were more abrasive and they needed some to get those stamps out.
So we were making crappy stamps, and we decided we are going to make different crappy stamps.
Yeah, they look pretty bad.
And I heard that during that time period, France sent us a letter saying, hey, your stamps look like crap. So we get to retaliate now.
Yeah. Making up for it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So are there, what kind of standards are in place now? It seems like anything goes now.
Yeah, I know.
Well, now, you know, chemicals come from every place. So we could make any color we want. As a matter of fact, there are some pretty cool color varieties that came out in the 1970s because we had like carcinogenic brown inks.
We had lead in our inks, and then around the
then we were licking those stamps.
Yeah, just don't eat them.
God, I almost said the worst thing ever. I said, yeah, don't lick your stamps. wait, crap.
But now we, you know, most things are produced by four color matched inks, and so a misregistration of the inks or one ink printing darker than the other will affect what color the eye sees. But that's why a lot of the stamps nowadays are listed as multicolored, because they're all printed on this four color process.
Oh, yeah, I've seen the selvage on modern ones, the color palette. It is not your standard cyan, magenta, etc. It's like there's all kinds. You can have eight different, quote, colors in one stamp.
Yeah,
and it's
but
this
a lot
custom
of them,
palette that they
but
use.
But a lot of them are printed by the four-color process.
Really?
Yeah.
Then how come they still have that weird color palette on
well,
the side?
It's
like
depends on what
ones.
Process they're using, what press they're using.
Okay. That would make a difference.
Okay, let's go ahead and get ready to open our Genishi. Drum roll, please.
It's here somewhere.
And this one's kind of interesting because there's enough play so that I can actually see the back of the envelope next to the cardboard. And I can see that there's no printing on the back, so I know this is a loser. And I'm going to open it anyway because I want the $12 in postage.
Man, we've gotten a lot of use out of that squawk box.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, by the way, a reminder, everybody, to know what I'm talking about, go on YouTube and do the search for, what is it, opening an inverted Jenny or whatever it is.
Uninverted Jenny.
And you'll know the trick that I'm talking about.
Yep, just search Professional Stamp Experts Uninverted Jenny and it will come up.
Okay, so you can email us at stampshowhere today@gmail.com, Twitter, StampshowHT, Facebook, StampshowHereToday, and our website, www.stampshowheretoday.com, with your questions and comments. You can now leave your questions and comments on a Google Voice answering machine anytime. Country code 1-949-873-4298. There is also a link to Google Voice on our website so you can make the call from your computer. And on that note, keep collecting. And happy 52nd year episode.
Happy anniversary.
Yay!
I'm Guy Gasser with HB Philatelics, and you're listening to Stamp Show Here Today.
Hi, this is Bobby Prager with Gary Posner Incorporated, based in Long Island, New York, and New Jersey. And I just want to say that the stamp hobby is alive and well here, and we love buying and selling stamps. We pay very, very, very good prices, so we'd rather buy 9 out of 10 collections than just a very small percentage of what we see. Also, check us out on our website at GaryPosnerInc.com. You'll see a lot of great stamps at great prices. And any questions, just feel free to call Bob at 1-800-323-4279. That's Bob Prager at 1-800-323-4279. And my cell number is 917-538-8133. Happy hunting out there.
This episode of Stamp Show Here Today is brought to you by the Philatelic Book of Secrets, the book that teaches you about repurfs, regums, color varieties, and much more. Get yours for $10 at www.philatelicsecrets.com today.
no such number, no such soul.